Coffee with a Coastie is brought to you by On the Coast Publications, the publishing house for On the Coast families and On the Coast over 55 community magazines on the central coast of New South Wales.
Welcome to Coffee with a Coastie. Today I've been given the opportunity to chat with David Kirkpatrick. David is an Australian country music artist born in Rockhampton, Queensland, and the son of Australian country music royalty Joy McKean and the late Slim Dusty. As a child, David spent his first six years on the road, living in a caravan with his family before going to boarding school and onto a successful career as an emergency medicine doctor. But he has always followed in his family's footsteps with his love of music, having been part of a band throughout his medical career and made appearances with his fine songwriting and singing featured on the Slim Dusty Family Reunion album. Since retiring from medicine in 2019, after nearly 30 years of service at Gosford Public Hospital, David formed the band Two Tone Pony with their latest single, A Life Well Lived, which is out now. So it is with great pleasure that I get to sit down and chat with David about life and Two Tone Pony. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much, Luke.
David, as I mentioned, you were born in Rockhampton, Queensland, whilst your parents were travelling around the country performing. When I think of this and think about the many kilometres you must have travelled around this wonderful country, both as a child and later in life, what made you choose the Central Coast to live and work?
Well, that's a funny story, is that I didn't really choose it. It chose me, in that, and music had everything to do with that, because I was working in bands all through my university career. I was working three or four nights a week at one stage. We were quite a successful rock band then. But I was getting towards the end of my studies, and I kept saying, "Look, I've got to wind back. I've got to concentrate on the studies." Unfortunately, I didn't wind back soon enough, so I actually had to do a supplementary exam at the end of my university course, and that meant that I, instead of graduating in December, I graduated in January. And by that time, you didn't have a choice where you got posted as an intern. You got posted where the need was. And luckily for me, it was only the year before that Gosford started getting its own interns sent up here. So I came up to Gosford and the Central Coast and absolutely loved it and never looked back. I met my wife here that year, so it was just sliding doors, isn't it? Then you look back and think, wow, if I hadn't have failed that last exam, I might never have been up here.
That's exactly right. And was your wife already on the Central Coast?
Well, Jane had come up here just for 1 year as well, having been trained in Sydney and living in all her life in Sydney. And she'd come up here to finish her midwifery degree. And save some money for an overseas trip with some girlfriends the following year. So we met, and those plans went out the window.
That's cool. I believe it's at the age of around six that you went to boarding school and eventually ended up in medicine. Though I've heard you say that you ran away four times from boarding school and eventually got expelled. How or what was it, the turning point towards excelling at school, and what advice did you give your kids? And would you give any child that may be experiencing what you went through to be able to go on and achieve greater things in life as you have done?
Wow. Well, look, I always did do well at school. I was at a school in rural Victoria in the Gippsland region, in a town called Sale, Gippsland Grammar School.
Oh, yeah.
And I actually did like boarding school the most of the time. You know, I didn't really dislike it. Like a lot of kids, it find it very difficult. You know, we only saw our parents three times a year, you know, the May holidays, September holidays, and Christmas holidays. That's the only time I saw my parents, because they weren't around for long weekends and things. So you could have been, you know, really, I mean, obviously I was homesick at times, but I look back on it now and think, the first couple of times that I ran away was with a couple of other blokes, and it was almost like a stupid dare. You know, we're only pretty young. I was only in like year six, you know, I'm talking end of primary school. But I did attract a bit of bullying. I had a year of, you know, not being so happy. And what happened was, my sister Anne, who's 6 years older than me, she was in the sister school to my school in Sale. And of course, she finished school that year before. And my parents had decided to do less touring and actually locate themselves in Sydney. Me being the usual stubborn little ass that I was, said, oh, no, I don't want to leave my school down here. Anyway, and so I started to think, well, Anne's not here anymore, everyone's away. So I did run away the last time. And as I said, I was in Sale. I made it as far as Bega in one day hitchhiking when I was about, God knows, 10. When you think back now, it makes your hair stand up in the back of your head.
You know, your own children do it.
No. You know, I what advice I give to people, don't be quite as stubborn, you know, just don't dig your heels in and think about things a bit more sensibly. But, you know, when you're 10 or so, that's not so easy. But look, I came to Sydney and I was a bit older actually, I was probably about 12. And I spent my last 4 years up here at Trinity Grammar School, the boarding school there. And that was a big shock to me because I did well at the last school. I didn't have to work very hard. Suddenly I arrived at Trinity Grammar School and I was a very small fish in a big pond and I really did have to actually put my head down and study. So I did, and I enjoyed studying. I enjoyed it. My mother was very academic. And she was a great reader, fantastic. She's a bibliophile. Her house is just packed with books. And she instilled in me a great love of reading. And I used to read heaps and heaps of books when I was a kid. Medicine actually ruined reading novels for me because you had to read so much study material on that I didn't feel like sitting down and relaxing with a book anymore, which is a shame. I did well at school. I actually always wanted to be a vet. Right. And actually went into veterinary science first year. That's what I wanted to do. And after about a year of that, I thought, man, maybe I'm not cut out to be a vet. And then I transferred to medicine and, I enjoyed it.
What was it that made you feel you're not cut out to be a vet?
This is, again, music. I was in a band, right? I realised that what I wanted to do was do large animal practice. You know, I didn't want to do pets, you know, small dogs and cats and stuff. Yeah. And my reasoning, which again, I was only 17. I was only 17 and a half when I went to boarding school. When I went to university. So I was quite young and didn't really think it through well. And I thought, wow, if I'm going to be a vet and then I'm going to be out in the country, I won't be able to play music as much. I won't be able to play with my mates in the band. Where if I do medicine, I can work in the city. And I made a complete career choice change based on that, which realistically, of course, didn't make any sense because when you're working as a doctor, you don't have time to be playing in bands, you know, especially when I first started. But that did come later.
Goes to show you how ingrained music is within your genes. Mm.
It was so important to me. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I wanted to do vet or I wanted to do medicine, it had to somehow fit in so I could still do music.
It's so ingrained. Wow. So it sort of brings that, growing up with parents that were popular, talented and simply amazing people within their craft, did that put pressure on you growing up or were you more excited by it?
I grew up with it, so it didn't seem special to me.
Yeah.
And sometimes I appreciated much more the accomplishments and the achievements of my parents when I got a bit older and I had my own children and I could see what they had done, because I just took it in my stride that, you know, by the time, I mean, I was born the same year the Pub No Beer became a worldwide smash hit. So
huge.
I always grew up with Slim and Joy being famous. Mm. So it wasn't unusual for me to be able to go to things because they were going to me, et cetera, et cetera. So I didn't see it as anything special when I should have. But, you know, again, you're a kid, you don't. Yeah. But I do now, and I still cherish a lot of those things. You know, like the seeing your father close the Olympic ceremony, singing to an audience of billions of people, you know, even then I was sort of, oh yeah, this is the sort of thing, dad will kill it, he'll be no problems. But when you think back on it now, how amazing, you know. So
very special.
Yeah, so I certainly appreciate it now, and it's great that I do, and it's great that my children appreciate it. Mm. They got to know him. There's their grandfather, but they also really appreciate what he did as a musician.
And it didn't create any pressure growing up at all?
No. There was no pressure on my parents that, oh, you're going to be Slim Dusty Jr. Yeah. That was never there.
Yeah.
No, my father was extremely proud of my academic achievements.
Yeah.
This is from a person who left school at the end of grade six, you know, and none of his family had done anything like this. And it was also very important to my mother because she actually turned down the chance to go to university so she could continue playing music.
Mm-hmm.
At that stage, it was becoming a potential career for her. So yeah. She had made that choice in her life, but they were both extremely proud that what I was doing and what I achieved in my own career.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, your band Two Tone Pony is made up of yourself, Ian Rhodes, Graham Puglisi, Glenn Wiley, and your brother-in-law, Greg Richardson.
Mm-hmm.
And you have mentioned in past interviews that the band was formed because your daughter asked you to perform at her wedding. As a dad, how does it feel to not only be able to produce the goods and form a band to perform at her wedding, but also have friends and family join together to make it happen and create the band we're here today?
Oh, it was very special. It was fantastic. Obviously, to be able to do that extra bit of involvement in Hannah's wedding, I mean, it was just terrific. And as I said, you know, my brother-in-law Greg is on drums, who I obviously we're always talked about music, and but we'd never been able to play in a band before. I mean, Greg was a studio manager and audio technician at Radio National for nearly 30 years, and so to get him and the band. As I said, Ian Rhodes and Graham Puglisi, we'd both played in bands up here and cover bands for like 20 years while I was working in medicine, and I'd known them for a long time. And then of course Glenn Willie, my friend on keyboards, he wasn't actually at the wedding. He joined the band a bit later when I was doing some demos and I sent them to him. Glenn's came up to me in year 11 at Trinity Grammar School and said, oh, I hear you play drums. Do you want to join a band? So that's how I first started. And he and I played all through university. He went on to become a specialist dental surgeon. And so he hadn't played any live music for a while until I invited him up, and then he's been in it. So yeah, to be able to put that band together, Hannah specifically wanted a country rock band, which was great. I'd always loved country rock, but I hadn't played it a lot. And that really, I realised that this is what I want to do, but I don't want to do another covers band. I want to actually put the effort in. I've got the time now to write original music, and I have a vision for my own sound, which combines my rock background and my country background, try and come up with our own sort of sound. So that's what we've been working on for the last 4 years.
Did you know at that time, when you formed the band for your wedding, that it would turn into the Two Tone Pony that it is today?
Pretty much. Yeah. Yep. As soon as we finished there, I said, right, we're going to continue on. I've got a few ideas, and pretty well we started rehearsing, and I started bringing some ideas in, and we started rehearsing straight away, and it just grew. Yeah. And it's all become a bit of a juggernaut at the moment, because my wife said, I thought we were retiring, and now you seem to be in a second career.
We're going on our next hiking trip. Whatever.
That's right. We have to have a band calendar, right? So we all now have to try and coordinate our holidays into blocks, so we've got blocks of time that we can go and play.
It's like the school holidays.
It is. It's just like that again. Yeah, that's right.
That's funny. Your latest single is called A Life Well Lived, and it's a phrase that you used in an introductory speech to honour your mother, Joy McKean, when she got her Ted Albert Lifetime Achievement Award at the APRA Awards in Sydney. Can I ask, how did this song come about, and what does A Life Well Lived look like and feel like to you?
Well, yeah, I'd really just like that phrase to describe, you know, someone who has a fantastically interesting and varied life like my mother. But I really just, when I was in my music room downstairs, and I was actually writing a song, a tune I had in my head. I had that phrase in my head. I thought, how can I use that? And then I thought about the conversations I've had with people, whether it be at work, whether it be in socially, and you ask about good times or they start talking about great times and memories, it's predominantly around relationships, about the time they've had with friends and family, or an unexpected, you know, event when you're traveling around the world and you have an unexpected act of kindness from someone to a tourist. It's all about that. As I've said many times, it's people don't tend to reminisce about the big car, the big job, the big money when they really get to the nitty-gritty of it. Mm. It really, to me, I would like to think that when I, you know, when I'm thinking back on my life, that I would hope that I have lived it well and I have given something, you know, and I certainly feel that with my job as an emergency medicine physician, feel that I have done good for a lot of people and to gain the respect and trust of your colleagues is incredibly important to me. So that's something that I reflect on, and I guess I just came up with the idea of an imaginary next door neighbour that I would go over and have a cup of tea with and chat with, and she'd tell me about her life, and then when you get to the end of the song, you've got the person, the younger person at the end of the song, then sitting in their own town realising, well, that's really what I want as well. So I hope that's how it comes across.
It's a very touching song. My nan passed away a little over a month ago, and listening to that song and watching the clip and watching the video and the old photos coming through it touched an emotional spot for me, I can tell you right now.
Well, I mean, those in the video, those clips are actually they come from Jane's family, Jane and Ruth. They're actually the home movies of their mother when she was a child and growing up. So we had permission from them to use that in the song to illustrate that sort of era and some of the things. So all that's a great family thing that, you know, that gets in, that we had so much of our families involved in that song and in the presentation of it. Yeah.
It makes sense. It's a big part of it because, yeah, I actually said it after I listened, I was like, you've got to listen to this, and went and showed my wife. I said, can you think of this? And Nan having just passed away, and it was a very, very touching moment to listen to that song, I must say.
Yeah, okay.
When it comes to your own songwriting, your life experiences range from growing up with musical parents to working as an emergency medicine doctor, along with a lot of trekking from the Kokoda Trail to the Himalayas, the Inca Trail, and other places around the world. Having had all these life experiences and more, what do you tend to find influences your music the most?
Wow. Well, there's two parts to it, really. I mean, there's the music and the lyrics. It was instilled very much in me when I was growing up. I watched two premier songwriters, you know, in my own house. So I saw the sort of how they took a song that often Dad had lyrics sent to him and he put it to music. But obviously he wrote songs and the lyrics, and I saw the effort that they put into the lyrics. They really are so important to whether it's telling a story or just talking about an emotion or anything. It's important that it makes sense. Don't skimp on the in making. And but of course it's very important for the music and the lyrics. I mean, my influences, as I've said, I grew up in country music. I then, typical teenager, was very much into the rock music of the 70s and in the 80s. And that's the era I would say I'm steeped in. Neil Young is a huge influence on me because he can play an acoustic ballad to a full-out electric, you know, wig out if he wants to. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Creedence. They've all got some country influences if you listen to it. And then my sister Anne, when she was at uni, went straight into a musical career. And she was at the forefront of country rock as it was starting in the 70s and really started that in Australia. And so she opened me up to a lot of the American influences, the Flowing Burrito Brothers, Emmylou Harris, etc. So I had those things all the time. And that's the music seeps into me like that, and that's I just found even if I tried to write a rock song, it always ends up with a country tinge. My daughter Hannah said that to me. I tried writing a few. I said, Dad, it still sounds country. You can't help it. It's just going to happen. So I don't fight it, you know. But I'm happy to you know, push the edge in various ways. And the thing is that you can in country music. It's so broad, you know. I mean, in America, country music is the pop music of America, of the middle America, because you don't get pop music like you did in the 70s. When you had Glen Campbell on the pop charts, you don't get that on the pop charts now. So it's, and I think it, when you go out to the country music festivals, you get outside the city, country music is huge in Australia. And the festivals, it's a big scene. So. And as I said, it crosses over a lot. You know, people want to go out and have a good time. They want something that's got a strong beat. But they really do like the lyrics that pertain more to the countryside of I don't know. You know, storytelling is in my vein, so I guess I tend to go that way.
Yeah, could imagine so. And actually, as you were just talking before about having watched your parents write songs for your life like that, the exposure to that would just be amazing.
Yeah, and you know, I spent a lot of time in the recording studios on my Christmas holidays because they would always come to Sydney. We used to have Christmas down at a place called Meetung in the Gippsland Lakes in Victoria.
And Meetung, then, I went to the Meetung pub recently.
Ah, great, fabulous pub, isn't it? Isn't it? We still have a little the holiday house down there. I mean, it's nothing special,
on
but
the
it's.
Lake.
Yeah, it's up Chinaman's Creek, at the top of Chinaman's Creek, just up, just out of Meetung Town.
Yeah.
And but then after Christmas in early January, we'd all pack up and come up to Sydney for a couple of weeks, and Slim and Joy would record an album. And I'd often spend days in the old EMI recording studios watching them record. So I had all of that experience as a kid, watching how records were made, you know, how songs were made. You know, what different artists would come in, how it would all happen. So it's watching the engineers with the old big reels, reel-to-reel tapes, not like digital today, which, you know, is so much easier. Having just recorded here on the Central Coast with Rod McCormack when we put these six tracks down, wow, just watching him in front of these computer screens and all that, it's just, the wizardry is just amazing, amazing what's available now, yeah.
That's awesome, that's amazing. Can only imagine the difference too,
and because
I've heard you talk about the differences between recording studios now and when you were growing up, and I just wondered, as you've started to talk about what those differences are, like you that stand out to you.
Well, it's the accessibility. I mean, you know, it was a big deal. I mean, I remember Dad doing his first demos on a reel-to-reel tape, a big one, you know, and chopping and changing, and then he had a cassette player. I mean, now for me. Like I have been driving down the M1 freeway and then pulled off at Mount White because I've got an idea that I've been humming in my head, get my phone out, put the voice memo on and put down a set of lyrics or a sing a couple of lines that I've got going in my head, bang, that's it, and I don't lose the idea. And if I'm at home, well, I've just got my laptop set up, I've got a microphone there, I can just press play, record, and I can just put down a quick and dirty demo so I don't lose that idea, and I can come back to it and really work on it properly.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I can put good demos down, then I send it out to the band members, and they all start to chip in with their ideas, and then we get together to rehearse, and away we go. So, I mean, you can record an album in your garage if you want, but I got to say, you know, we did do some recording in our rehearsal garage, and it sounds pretty good. But when you go to a real proper studio, it goes, there's no comparison.
Add Rod's wizardry. And
just this layout, the production, and also it's great. Producers are really important because they're listening from outside. You get an idea and you get very biased. You need someone to say, you know, I don't think that's working, but if you did this, it may. Yeah. And then you've got to be open to that. You've got to leave your ego at the door when you walk into a recording studio.
Yeah.
In fact, as I've said to people, you have to have a very thick skin if you want to be in a band. because you think you're doing something really great, and the others say, nah, it's not really very good. So you've got to bounce back from that and be prepared to take it on the chin and actually come back with something and improve it.
Yeah, or take that as constructive.
Yeah, well, you do. You don't take it as negative. You just say, yeah, okay, all right, how can I improve it?
Yeah, it's funny, actually. I didn't realise what a producer's role was, if you like, until and this goes to show you how recent I've sort of started looking, a little over a year ago or more, was come across Rick Rubin.
Yep.
And was looking at a lot of Rick Rubin stuff and really started going down, like, in his latest book. And like, and I'm just like, role of Rick Rubin. Like,
That's right. It's just like, that's right. Some people, they can really, really have a major influence. Yeah. And the more I've been listening to a lot of podcasts by producers talking about, you know, a lot of the great artists they've worked with, and they really can put a big imprint for better or worse sometimes as it works out. But someone like him has obviously got a great genius touch, because he did one of my favourite all-time albums, the Wildflowers by Tom Petty. He did that, and what sounds like a simple song is awfully the hardest thing to do. To get it right.
Well, so his whole thing was—he talks about stripping it back.
Yep, stripping it back, and you'll hear that on those songs. To allow, you don't have to have 20 guitars on something, but there are tracks on there with lots and lots of guitars and stuff, so you can do it both ways.
Yeah,
yeah.
But yeah, no, and listening to his podcast too, actually.
Okay, great.
I watched you and your sister Anne sing the song "Old Purple" about Dad's car.
Yeah.
When I listen to these lyrics. Kids in the back, guitar and hat, and Old Purple hits the road. I can't help but wonder what your favourite memory was about Old Purple as a kid in the back.
Well, I got to tell you, the first time Dad drove up in that car, as I said in the song, I hated it. I thought, purple car. I'd had a bad experience with purple as a kid, and I just didn't like the colour. I think one of the iconic, you know, things about that car was being in outback Australia and that car driving in. It was so easily recognisable. And you got it was the worst possible car to take out on the road, on the roads they were on, you know. Yeah. But it's amazing. It never broke down. I can't believe it. You know, you think the axle would get knocked out of it on those roads.
Yeah.
By the time Dad got that car, I was at university, so I didn't do a lot of touring or anything with him at those stages. I have great memories of the old cars that we had when I was, six and sitting in an old, it used to be a big, big truck, a big international. And Dad used to drive that. All the gear was in the back for the stage shows.
Yes.
And I remember sitting Dad driving and me in the middle. And, on long trips and having to do different things. And I remember Anne reading me books, you know, to keep me amused as a five-year-old in those sort of... So I certainly remember those times.
Because I have to say, ask then, because I showed when looking at my daughter would come up and go, Dad, what are you watching? I'm researching David. Like, yeah. You know, I'm watching the film clip, the video for Old Purple. And there's a young child in the back standing up.
Oh, yeah.
And first question is, who's that child? But the other question is, my daughter's like, didn't they have baby seats? Like, you know, she's seven. She's like, where's the child? There's no seatbelts in the back of that thing.
Yeah, right. Well, that's my niece, Kate. That's Anne's daughter.
Yeah.
So that was taken, actually, a scene out of when they did the Slim Dusty movie. So that was a scene that when Kate was actually with Anne while they were touring around Australia doing different spots and that doing that and look just in case there's any child safety people out there, it was staged for the camera. She did have a seat.
It was just funny that it triggered
exactly
it
right
triggered that in
that our kids are saying, you shouldn't be doing that.
How's she stand up in the back?
Yeah, that's that? Right. Yeah. I'm not allowed to do that.
that's right. So what has been your most memorable moment in life that you've written a song about?
Well, gosh, that I've written a song about. Well, I mean, every person should write a song to their wife, and I did. Okay. And then that's one of the songs that I did record. And it's actually going to be our next single. And
well,
I, and
we
I
probably
tell
can't
this,
say then.
I can say, but I tell, because when I'm playing, I explain this. And
yeah.
I said, well, came around to my wife, I said, I've written a song about us, you know, and us together. And she said, oh, that's lovely. And what have you called it? And I said, I've called it Stormy Weather. And she said, really? And I said, no, you're going to see, we'll get through any stormy weather, et cetera, et cetera. So, I was pretty pleased to write that and that she liked it. I guess that's the most important thing.
And that you got through the stormy weather.
Then we got through, that's right, I wasn't in trouble.
That's cool. In researching you, I come across the cover of your dad's album, Sing Along With Dad. I believe it's you, your mum, your sister on the cover.
Yeah.
And I wondered, can you share some memories of singing with your family as a child? And how did those experiences shape your love for music?
Well, yeah, I hate that cover, I got to tell you. I absolutely hate it.
It's very staged.
Well,
I think grandfather clock.
Yeah, but it's not so much that, is it? You're very self-conscious when you're a kid and having been put on the cover like that. And it was very staged. And we didn't sit around the campfire singing songs every night. And actually, what we did have a tradition of is, but with music, and my parents were very tolerant of listening to any music, you know. And so when I was, you know, I remember asking my dad, which he did do, he took me to see the Monkees movie, because I was a huge Monkees fan when I was sort of 10 years old. And it's a terrible movie. And poor dad had to sit through this sort of psychedelic mishmash and say, okay, all right. But, you know, He did that. He bought me Black Sabbath albums that I wanted. So if that was, you know, he was wasn't going to say to me, you can't listen to that. He was quite happy with that. So what we did used to do was, we at Christmas time when we were on holidays, we didn't have a television or anything. We had a record player, and so each night everyone had a turn at picking a record to play and one side of it. So, you know, Dad would be putting on Buck Owens or Merle Haggard, and Mum would be putting on, she was really into folk music at that stage, and Anne might have the Beatles, and, you know, I'd be wanting to put on Led Zeppelin or something, just to be obnoxious probably. But that was fine. Everyone put up with it. It was fine. Everyone had a choice, and everyone had to sit there and listen to it, whether they wanted to or not. So I got tolerant too. I wasn't saying, oh, I'm not listening to that. I listened to all that stuff. I love Merle Haggard, I love Buck Owens, and I still did, even when I was listening to Led Zeppelin. I would still sit down and very happily listen to Buck Owens. So it did give me that breadth of, if it's good music, it's good music.
Mm.
You know, if someone's good at it, no matter what music, it's worthwhile. You know, if you appreciate music, you can pick good music, whether you particularly like the genre or not.
Mm.
You can still appreciate someone who's playing an instrument well, who's got a good voice. You know, it can be in whatever style.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I think that, I'm sure you know of Courtney Kyle as well. Mm. I remember when I spoke to Courtney, she was like, one of her pieces of advice for someone coming was, listen to all genres, listen to everything you can, listen. You know, don't, just because you might sing country or you might sing this, you want to listen to as much music, different genres that you can, to gain that understanding and just to get that insight across the different genres.
Absolutely, because, you know, it's you might, you know, different things trigger different emotions in people. Why do people like something? They might like the sound of your voice, or they like the way that voice marries with the style. You know, you go back to, you know, Bob Dylan and Neil Young, they don't have the best voices, you know, classically, obviously. but their voices suit exactly the music and the emotion and the story they're trying to get across, and no one else could do it. And that's why people identify with it. So, I you know, when I'm in the car, when I was used to be driving to work and back, I have classical music on the radio because it's calming to me. I don't want to be, I'm already jumped up enough. I actually want something that's just soothing and just, you know, I don't know a lot about classical music, but I do like, don't mind classical music at all. Again, I appreciate the virtuosity of the musicianship. Mm. Whereas I'm not a big opera fan, I just don't like that style of music. But it is important to listen to all genres and say, why do I like that particular song in a genre that I don't usually like? You know, it's because of the voice, or it's because of the instrumentation. It's the way they've constructed the song. You know, now that I'm writing songs, I'm really fascinated by the way people put songs together and what a little twist or a turn. You know, I mean, Neil Finn to me is one of the best songwriters I've ever heard in my life, because he writes and then suddenly there's a little unexpected twist to it, or he just has a little hook that comes out of nowhere. But he's so melodic. I think, you know, to me, he's, as a tunesmith, he's like Paul McCartney. He's just got an ear to pick it. I mean, I just think he's up there on a pedestal, as far as I'm concerned. He's so amazing. Yeah.
It's interesting though when you say like about listening to the classical going to work, obviously because you at the time going to work as a medical doctor and high stress and you want to relax. Do you like, I know like I can listen to music and I'll listen to it because of the way it makes me feel rather than, but don't know technically why it makes me feel like that. Mm. But like obviously with classical, having your understanding and your background and your everything, when you feel something about a song, do you find yourself automatically then trying to pick it apart a little bit to try to work out why is it making you feel this way?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's like, it's a bit of a curse at times. Sometimes I don't, but I'm terrible when I go to concerts because I'm always, oh, what's the guitarist doing? What's he doing? What guitar is he playing? Yeah. What you know, can I see what amp he's got? What are they doing? You know, instead of sometimes just enjoying the whole bit. But I do like, you know, the whole experience. That's right. But I do like to see, you know, what instruments they're playing. What you know, what's the band doing to make it very interesting for me, and as a performer. If I go to watch a band and they're not very good, I'm not very good at sitting there because I'm going, oh, no, I can't stand this.
That's cool. Now, I heard a song, and I'm not sure if it's a Two Tone Pony song or whether it's your own song pre-Two Tone Pony, but it's in your SoundCloud for Two Tone Pony, so I'll bring it up, and that's Going Back.
Oh, yeah.
And I've heard you speak about an image in your head when writing it as being one of your dad driving back to his childhood home. Though I cannot help but get an image in my head when listening to it of you returning to your family's roots after all these years. Mm. Do you ever feel this when performing this song?
Yeah, well, Going Home was one of the first songs I wrote for this band.
Oh, so,
I would say that's the start of my current career as a songwriter. I'd written Old Purple and those songs for the family reunion album, but this was the first time I'd written something that. And again, yes, initially when I had an idea of when we still have the farm that Dad grew up on in Kempsey, and so you drive in, you know, it's an hour's drive inland from Kempsey into the hills, and it's a beautiful Nulla Creek, Nulla Valley. Driving down there with the hills and that. And so I just had that image of driving back because you're coming from the coast and you're coming inland. But yeah, then it really took off from there. And then it just became a bit of an idea of a prodigal son. I hadn't actually thought about me going back to my family roots. Maybe there's something I hadn't. And it's actually, I've heard this before with songwriters, people have different interpretations of their own song.
Yeah.
And I've heard songwriters say, it's not up to me to tell people that interpretation's wrong, because they might be right. I may not have realised that at the time.
Yeah, interesting.
I put that up on SoundCloud because that's one of the ones we recorded in our band rehearsal garage. I think we will go back and re-record that and put that out again, because I think we perform it all the time. It's one of the opening tracks that we do whenever we perform live.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really good song. And all the band, you know, love it. So it is on our agenda to go back and record. There's about three songs from that that you, we used to have on our website and things like that. And that, well, including our signature song, Two Tone Pony, about the, which is where we got the name from the band. So we should go back and we will go back and record those future. We're going to go back in the studio in May, very soon, and record another 4 to 6 songs with Rod McCormack. And then we'll have an album's worth of songs. We're going to release some more singles this year and most likely put an album out early next year. So we'll have a good collection of music for people to listen to.
Which brings me on to my next question, actually. Mm-hmm. I know you've only just released A Life Well Lived. That can we expect more releases from Two Tone Pony in the near future?
Well, you definitely can. That's right. We'll have another single coming out called Stormy Weather. And... In June.
That's right. And surviving the stormy weather.
So that's right.
You're not stuck in the stormy weather. We're through the stormy weather.
Yeah, that's right. So we'll be putting that one. We're putting a new single out there and there. And then we don't know what the next single will be because it may be one of the new songs that we record. And we're still in a bit of decision of, you know, when we put out an album, when we put out singles. It's, again, this whole new era of digital streaming. It's very different to the old days, and you got to be very, you know, think about how you put your stuff out so that the streaming services still put it up there and give it some air to breathe, so to speak. So we're learning that industry as we go along. But we've got a lot of music. You know, we've got 2 albums worth of songs right now, easy, and we're writing all the time. So in fact, I had 2 of the boys here this morning running through a new song that I've got in my head. So we're always coming up with new stuff all the time. And we've got plenty of more music to come.
Are you the sole writer? And how's that work with Two Tone Pony?
Well, no, Ian Rhodes, the singer-songwriter in the band, plays guitar. He also a bit of the multi-instrumentalist. He plays mandolin and lap steel, and he's very good on a harmonica. And Ian writes. It's good. Ian has a very different approach. He's got a very quirky view on life. So he comes up with some very interesting lyrics. And he has a different style of writing, which still lyrical and story based. And I'm able to, you know, put a bit of the country feel into his songs. It's about an 80-20 split at this moment. I probably do about 80% of it, and Ian does 20. I mean, Ian's the only member of the band who's still trying to hold down a full-time job, so he hasn't quite got the same amount of time as I have to dedicate to this, so, to be fair to him, and look, I don't know if any of the others will, but I think in the future we'll probably have some more, maybe some band collaborations with an idea and then get the band to come in, because as you work with a band more, you become more comfortable with sharing your ideas to them. Before, I'd bring forth a completely fully formed demo that had everything I thought should be done. I don't feel the need to do that now. I've got the idea of the song, and I think I need to give the rest of the band more time, more space for them to put their ideas into the song so that I'm not prejudicing them by saying, you know, well, I've all, you know, because I'd sent out a demo track and I had all the guitars on it, I had the bass line, I'd play drums. The only thing I can't play is keyboard. So it's better now not to do that and let them get their right. That's what a band is. And now as we've been together and we're comfortable and we know everyone's committed to it, it's growing more organically now, songs.
How much of an impact does someone like Rod as a producer have on that sound as well?
Oh, a lot. I mean... It didn't change our sound. He honed our sound. So, and he just filled the gaps where we didn't realise there were gaps, and say, you know, that intro would be much better if you actually took that lovely keyboard line you had and actually put it at the front of the song as well, because it suits the song. And it was right, you know. I start off with a bit of a guitar line. You say, well, if you actually had some acoustic guitar coming in there, it would actually balance it much better. That's what he does. So he just gave it the polish you know, which is what you expect. And then, of course, his brother Jeff, he does the mastering of the tapes as well. So he's, Jeff's, you know, very good. He's a bass player and great singer and been in the music business his whole life, just like Rod has. So the two of them worked together in there. And you immediately felt comfortable to just trust your songs to Rod and take on board what he was saying. Yeah, he never pushed anything on you, but he had the right advice at the right time.
Can I ask, how did you end up coming across using Rod, purely from being on the Central Coast? Obviously, he's got a very good name for himself, as you have. Like, there would be an awareness of each other, for sure, without a doubt.
Yes, I've known Rod for a long time on the Central Coast, obviously as a musician, and come across him in music. But we actually did cross paths socially earlier on as well. So, and we knew each other from there. I'd been to his studio a couple of times. I think Anne did some stuff there. And another time I was doing a charity concert for some friends for raising funds for multiple sclerosis out at a friend's property at Arimba. And I asked Anne to come up and do a bit of a guest spot. And so I actually approached Rod and Jeff if they would back us, which, of course, you know, out of the generosity of the hearts, they did, you know. So we actually went and did a little rehearsal session at the studios, which were fairly newly built then. And so looking around them and, we had done some recording in Sydney with a producer called Matt Fell, who's another really up there producer. But he, unfortunately, decided to move to Tasmania, so we didn't have the resources to go to Tassie to record. I mean, it was a no-brainer. I said, look, Rod's got a fantastic studio. He's a great musician. He's got a great ear. He's got a fantastic, you know, he's got all the rums on the board. I mean, for us, why would we go anywhere else? Yeah.
Talk about those things aligning again.
It really aligns. It does. Things align. Yeah.
Amazing. I understand Two Tone Pony performed some covers as well. And in an interview, I heard you say that you always open the second set with a version of Slim Dusty's Looking Forward, Looking Back, because it is an important song in your life. When I listen to the chorus of the song, Looking Forward, Looking Back, I've come a long way down the track. Got a long way left to go, making songs from what I know. I can't help but think of treasuring one's life journey. Would you be kind enough to share a little about what this song means to you?
Well, it means a lot. I've sort of taken that on as my signature Slim song. I love singing it. It's a beautiful song, written by Don Walker from Cold Chisel for Slim, and written specifically for Slim's 100th album, which was entitled Looking Forward, Looking Back. It's a beautifully constructed song, and it's lovely to sing. And it's very simple in what it says, but again, it's a bit like a life well lived, really, when I think about it. It is about, you know, looking forward, looking back. So many people have come to me, even when I was working, and, you know, would say, it's a song that a lot of people play at their parents' funerals or at friends' funerals for obvious reasons, if they're Slim Dusty fans or even not Slim Dusty fans. And it's a personal favourite of my mother's, and I know she loves hearing me sing it. And it's all the band love it. So it's something I've always played, and I just thought, well, people, you know, I don't want people coming along to our concerts thinking they're going to hear bush ballads, because they're not. But I really like to play, you know, a song of Dad's. And in fact, we're going to do quite a few other cover versions. We're going to do a Lights on the Hill and Indian Pacific as part of we're actually going up to Charleville in Queensland in July, doing a festival up there. And we're going to do a little Slim Dusty tribute, three song section in the middle of our set, which they asked us to do. So we'll do that while we're up there. That's one of the covers I do of Dad's, you know. I mean, yeah, well, we do lots of other cover songs. So I do Neil Young's song, and we do Green River by Creedence, and we do the old Buffalo Springfield for What It's Worth, and we do where we do a couple of Tom Petty songs. We do Free Falling, and I get to play a beautiful 12-string electric guitar that's belonged to a friend of mine that I've got on loan. So I think it's important, especially when you're starting off as a band and you're doing a 3-hour, you know, doing 3 hours in a pub with a couple of sets. It's important to do some cover songs as well. And we do ones that are within the realm of what we like to hear ourselves. And if people like that, then they'll listen to our couple of originals, go, oh, they're good too. Yeah, so that's how it comes about.
Yeah, yeah. And as you mentioned, it's like the life we lived, even in the club clip. The film clips of your dad looking back through the photo album where you got the old photos and
I
did see the similarities there as well.
Yeah, that's very good, very good. Yeah, that because that's a great film clip. Yeah, it's exactly right. They were looking through the photo album and that was because it was at that stage in his career, we were at the 100th album, you know, he didn't have many more milestones that he could do. And it was, that was a really lovely video. I remember that.
Yeah.
And him driving up in the old purple car at the front.
When I watched it, I thought this must be one of the first ones where they took the time to sort of small movie length, like where he drives up and he's got a Henry Lawson poem at the beginning. And
that's right. Like did go to some good lengths there. A bloke called Mark Jago, who was doing a lot of big videos at that time, and it was actually his house at Terry Hills that he drove up to and went inside, and they just did it, and he shot it in there, and then he did all the post-production stuff, which was amazing.
It was good to watch. It was lovely to watch. Finally, I've heard you say your dad Slim's credo was, stay true to what you are and what you believe. Don't try to be what you're not. Looking at your life, having gone into medicine and performed part-time in bands all your life, to now later in life forming Two Tone Pony, and your debut single being titled A Life Well Lived, it would seem to me that you have followed your dad's advice and stayed true to what you are and what you believe. So I'd really like to know your advice for someone not quite living by the same credo, maybe even the advice you gave to your own kids growing up.
Well, it pretty well is that. It's about, I've always believed that, you know, you have to have belief in what you are doing is right. Doesn't mean you can't listen to other people and take advice and reflect and maybe I need to rethink what I'm doing. But, you know, I found that belief in myself when I started working as an intern, as a doctor. I mean, when you're a medical student, you don't really know whether you're going to be any good at this or not. Reality, I mean, you know, university doesn't prepare you for being in an emergency department at 3 a.m. in the morning when you're bone tired and someone walks in the door with someone really sick and you know you've got to perform. And I found that I could do that. A lot of people hate working in emergency, and I found I really liked working with a staff, a group. Thing about I love working in emergency is that it's not just you. It's everyone around you. You can't do your job without your fellow colleagues and staff trusting you to lead and believe what you're doing. Because you can't sit around discussing what you need to do in emergency. You've got to say, right, this is what we're going to do. And you need to have the trust of your staff by proving to them that you can be, that your decision making is good and sound. And I guess I'd take that into the rest of my life. And, you know, you have to, we're like all families and, you know, you can have family disagreements and you've got to say, well, look, I believe this is the right thing and I'm not changing it, because no matter what people might say about us, in the end, if we stick to being true to what we believe is the right thing to do, truth will come out and it will be seen that way in the end. I'd maybe not explaining myself very well, but it is a matter of being true to yourself, true to your family, true to your friends, and true to what you state that you believe. You've got to actually do what you say you should do. A lot of people might state that I believe this and I do this, but if you don't actually do it, you know, you have to be prepared to stand up and sometimes be unpopular at times. You don't do something that's hurtful to anyone, but you have the right to say, I don't agree with you. It doesn't mean that I don't like you. This is what distresses me about the state of Australian politics and Australian society, is it's so polarised. You know, you can't say, oh, no, I don't agree with that, and then immediately get labelled as being anti this or anti that. It just isn't helpful. You know, it doesn't help any argument at all. You know, you have the right to disagree. You don't have the right to hurt someone. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like people saying, oh, you know, I like to speak my mind. There's a difference about speaking your mind and hurting someone. You know, you don't have to do that. You can do it in another way. And I never see the point in wanting to knowingly say something that you know is going to hurt someone. I just don't see what the point of that is. And I'm not a person, I don't like conflict, never have, and I always prefer to be a peacemaker than with conflict, but if push comes to shove, I will stand my ground. Mm. But I don't like to court conflict, I should say. Mm. And I don't see that that's helpful. But at times you have to be steadfast. I think you can do that without necessarily having to have conflict.
And allow people to grow in their own way.
Yeah, gotta let people go their own way. Mm. It's like your kids, you know, you can only tell them and say, well, look, it's very satisfying now because, you know, my kids are in their 30s now. And it's satisfying that they look back and say, well, you know, you showed us because you and Mum did this, and you always did this, and you stuck to that.
Led by example.
You led. So they say, I took that as an example. You didn't have to sit me down and give me a set of rules. You just showed me how to live those rules, and then I could make. It's up to them to make a decision. Is that how they want to live their life? And again, hopefully it's a life well lived. They showed them how to live their life and they think that wasn't such a bad idea.
That's right. So there you go. It seems like it's the perfect debut release, a life well lived at the end of it, isn't it?
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe. Well, that's it. And thank you very much for your time today, David. It's been an absolute pleasure, right, sitting and chatting. And I look forward to hopefully seeing that debut album in the coming year for Two Tone Pony. If anyone would like to hear more of David and Two Tone Pony, go to twotonepony.com. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Luke. It was a pleasure.
Coffee with the Coastie is brought to you by On the Coast Publications, the publishing house for On the Coast families and On the Coast over 55 community magazines on the central coast of New South Wales.